freak athlete, former five-star recruit, never really put it all together from a production standpoint, did not grade well in the system, did not earn high pass win percentages. You look at Chase Winovich, on the other hand, very good production, great pressure total, great pass win percentage, and it's because he's more technically sound. He took that Michigan coaching and turned it into what it could be. Rashawn Gary still needs a lot of technical improvement to be his best in the NFL.
You know, it's funny. Listen, a lot of teams, and I was just mentioning Oakland last year, San Francisco last year, they want a left tackle, and they want to protect their biggest investment, which is always the quarterback. And for a long time, Jonah Williams was the guy. Then I saw Andre Dillard, Alabama, and Wazoo, respectively. Now the name I'm seeing, the top offensive tackle, is going to be Juwan Taylor from the Gators program. If you had to have a tackle, where do you go?
Jonah Williams is number four overall player on PFF's big board for a reason. We think he can play tackle despite him having two eighths of an inch short arms. We don't really care about that. He produced at a high level, was a starter at Alabama for a long time, both at right tackle and at left tackle. Talking to him in this pre-draft process, this is a man that builds his own Excel spreadsheet by charting the opponents he's going against pre-game, watches all of their pass rushes in their career to see what they use most and what they win on most, turns that into a spider chart of his own, and uses that to know his opponent and beat his opponent. He makes up for what he lacks in measurables with intellect and a commitment to getting better. I love this kid out of Alabama more than those players in this class.
Is there a name or two, and we don't want to disparage any of these young men, but is there a name or two you keep seeing his name in the first round and you kind of shake your head like, nah, you don't want to draft that guy?
And those the names that come out for me when you say that is Rashawn Gary out of Michigan and Montez Sweat out of Mississippi State. Both of those players blew the combine off the doors. Extreme elite athletes. However, the production wasn't there at the college level, nor was the technique. You can take these guys that you want to mold into the elite players in the NFL in the first round and watch them crumble because they don't have high floors. They don't have the technique to back up and stay a solid player in the NFL for a long time. That's what I see with Rashawn Gary and Montez Sweat. Yes, they're the athlete, but I want to see the player, the football player, more than I do to draft him in the first round.
This is the only sport where need takes into it. I think if you draft for need in the NBA, then you pass on Jordan and KD like they did in Portland. In baseball, hockey, it doesn't matter. You just draft the best player. So some people, like I know Reggie McKenzie when he was in Oakland, he always said his big board did the draft. Almost like you write the big board and you go home and let the robots take care of it. But that can't possibly be true. If you already have a great quarterback and your big board says the next guy's a quarterback, you're not gonna draft that guy. So how much are you on the flexibility for need? Because, you know, we do know a lot of times if you draft for need, you do pass on a great player. Where do you stand in that philosophy?
You have to draft good players first and foremost. I think quarterback is the only position that will affect your big board significantly. If you have an elite quarterback that you know you don't want to spend a high draft pick on a younger one, that's when you're going to push quarterbacks, though as talented as they are, down a little bit on your draft board compared to other teams. However, every other position, you need to build it in favor of the best player available and stick to it. The worst thing that can happen is that you have a lot of good football players on your team at similar positions. That's not a bad spot to be in. You can start to create better teams with better players. When you start to reach for need, especially when your team's not within winning reach in the next couple of years, that's when you start to put your roster in bad situations and make bad picks.
You know, a lot of times because the quarterback is such an important position, you line these guys up and it's like, well, we need a quarterback. Who's left? And it's usually some 6'4" kid who's going to come into the league and throw a bunch of interceptions and be out in 3 years. What do you think about Daniel Jones out of Duke? Because I've seen some people say that that's the guy the Redskins will key on at 15.
It's a reach in the first round, in our opinion. We see Daniel Jones as a third-round prospect that never graded well at the collegiate level, despite having excellent coaching at Duke, despite having all the measurables, all the intangibles in the book for a quarterback position. He's tall, he's smart, had the coaching. He just didn't get it done. He makes late reads, struggles under pressure, and didn't get to do a good enough job even from a clean pocket. We don't like him in the first round. We see him as a third-round player.
Let me just throw a couple more questions at you. You're in the war room. You need a wide receiver. It's late in the first round. There's A.J. Brown, and there's Deebo Samuel. Which way do you go?
I'm going A.J. Brown. I love his size. I love him as a big slot in the NFL with versatility to play outside. When DK Metcalf got hurt last year, the last three or four games at Ole Miss, A.J. Brown moved outside and produced well, still played very well. I love that versatility, but he served best in the slot. I think he can dominate in the NFL from the slot. He's a yak monster that creates separation and forces missed tackles.
You know, it's funny, the Cardinals doing their due diligence, they want to interview everyone, they're going to put up some smoke screens just in case somebody comes in and is going to offer six first-round picks for Kyler Murray. There's some sort of Bobby Beathard or Mike Ditka type of deal. But is this more or less, with the Kingsbury and everything else, a fait accompli that they're going to take Murray and move on from Rosen?
If I was a betting man, I would bet on them taking Kyler Murray at number one overall. The only way that doesn't happen is if they're given an offer they can't refuse. That's 2-3 first-round picks to move back a few slots. I don't see that happening outside of maybe the Raiders, because they have that capital, because they have 3 first-round picks this year and 2 next year. They're the only team that comes to mind that can make a move from 4-1. However, I think Cliff stays there, takes Kyler, pushes, moves on from Josh Rosen for whatever they can get from another team.
And outside of Josh Jacobs, who is your – because it's funny how split – I've heard a lot of people talk about their next favorite running back, and it's all over the place. Who's your next favorite guy after Josh Jacobs?
I love Miles Sanders out of Penn State. He came in, replaced Saquon Barkley. We're a 5-star recruit that sat behind probably the only running back in the country that could have put him on the bench in Saquon Barkley. Came in this past year and blew the doors off of Penn State. He forces his tackles very quick. Love his vision. I think this is the guy people are sleeping on because he only has 1 year of stellar production. But keep in mind, he only has that 1 year because Saquon Barkley, the number 2 overall pick last year, was playing ahead of him at Penn State.
Last question, 7th round, you're going to take a flyer, somebody who some people say is going to be an undrafted free agent, but you're like, no, I want him in camp. Who would be a guy way back at the end of the draft?
I look at Preston Williams out of Colorado State as the guy there in the 7th round. He has some off-field concerns, some character concerns. Went through the ringer, had to transfer from Tennessee to Colorado State, then had to sit out a year, broke all of Colorado State's track records after not playing track in high school. Former 5-star recruit that just has a lot of red flags that will push him into the deep day three range. Take a flyer on him and see if he can turn around the NFL, because he is an elite talent, very athletic, and has a stupid high ceiling if he can put it all together in the NFL.
That's why we have Austin Gale from Pro Football Focus on the show. I say, give me a 7th round guy, and right there, Preston Williams comes out. Austin, we always appreciate your time. Make sure to follow him at PFF_AustinGale, and that's GAYLE. Great stuff, and we look forward to talking to you real soon. I know this is your busy season.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right, and lines are open. We're going to get into a little talk on the Dubs on the other side with Dieter Kurtenbach as well. But as you can see, I asked him 1,000 questions. I have 10,000 more questions about the draft. I love the draft. And as a Raider fan, I start looking at the draft right around Halloween, unfortunately. On 95.7, The Game.
Now back to 95.7, The Game. Here's Rick Tittle.
Very pensive, tense music as we come back here. You're on the clock. What are you going to do? That's why I love the draft, man. Remember the Johnny Manziel draft? You had Aubrey Huff on this microphone saying you can't pass Johnny Manziel. I was on this mic saying my man crush was Khalil Mack and was not going out on a limb. I think we all had a man crush on Khalil Mack, but it was just that 1%. 1%. We all knew Johnny Manziel would suck, but you never really know. What if he was the human highlight reel and you passed on the Heisman winner? What would happen? And that was the itch that hit Jerry Jones, and he wrote Johnny Manziel on the card, and he started to take it up in his, well, call anyway. And his son Steven said, no, Zach Martin, a guard, Notre Dame. A guard? That's not sexy. I want Johnny football. And all Martin has done has been all pro since he's come into the league. And we know Johnny Manziel, by the way, I don't know if you saw, he changed his name legally to John Manziel. So now we have to call him John Football. It doesn't have the same type of ring to it. John Football. All right. Speaking of John Football, Let's go to John Everything, and that is Dieter Kurtenbach, the sports columnist with the Bay Area News Group. He does it all, and we're here to talk about our Golden State Warriors. And Dieter, you know, I kind of thought we were going to get through that game without any ejections or shenanigans. I just thought it would be a lot of smack talk and posturing, but we didn't get there. We got within 4 minutes, and it seemed like Durant didn't really care. He exacted his revenge, and I kind of feel like he got it out of his system, especially as he got two tees and he only has a few more to play with here. What did you think about that whole fracas?
I didn't necessarily think too much of it in the moment, even though Kevin Durant's a guy who obviously this season has had his run-ins with officials, and seems like his entire season has been defined by sort of emotional conflicts. Us versus Durant, Durant versus Draymond Green, Durant versus the referees. He had 16 techs in the regular season. Well, had it not gotten rescinded, he would have, I guess, not gotten suspended. He literally went up to the limit. So this guy knows what he's doing when it comes to technical fouls. But I really didn't think that much of it, in the sense that the Warriors were up big. Patrick Beverley was super annoying all game. And what the hell? Like, it wasn't going to affect the outcome. So Kevin Durant might as well have a little bit of fun with Patrick Beverley. And maybe Beverley knocks it off. I thought it was actually, all things considered, a pretty telling tactic that the Clippers went with Beverley on Durant from the first possession of game one. That's like a last resort tactic, and yet they were using it as the first resource. It's interesting as to what the Clippers think of themselves against these Golden State Warriors. I don't necessarily agree with their assessment, but the fact that they were willing to kind of throw it all up against the wall from the first moment is fascinating.
Yeah, and I kind of get it in a way, because here we are talking all day yesterday and in the days leading up about Curry's ankles and what is Beverly going to do. But the one thing we know about Curry is that, you know, 999 times out of 1,000, he's not going to get himself thrown out. And so you think about going all Nelly, like when he put Steven Jackson on Dirk Nowitzki. It's like, what the hell is this? It's like, let's put a spin on it. And you know what? Durant's the kind of guy, maybe you can get him thrown out, and then you're trading a pawn for a queen.
Yeah, as Steve Kerr said after the game last night, the Clippers have made a lot of good trades this year, but Patrick Beverley for Kevin Durant in last night's game was probably their best one. And it makes perfect sense as to why you would go at Durant, considering everything I just said. He's an emotional dude, and he has had trouble controlling his emotions on the court this season. He will take himself out of games, or he'll sort of overextend himself in games. He plays in waves, and Steph Curry's not going to do that. You know, Klay Thompson's not going to do that. Draymond can do that, but you might only just be bringing out the best in Draymond by doing that. They didn't really have an alternative. They went at DeMarcus Cousins with double teams and triple teams. It worked effectively. And then they threw Beverley at Durant, and it wasn't enough. And that's the trade-off the Clippers had to make in that. Basically, they were betting that the Warriors' other three All-Stars weren't going to beat them. Like, you had to put Patrick Beverley on Stephen Curry from the opening tip. Otherwise, Stephen Curry's going to do what Stephen Curry did last night. And now the adjustment that you make is that you leave Beverley on Durant, and maybe Durant decides he wants to make an example out of Patrick Beverley in game two and maybe stiffens up a little bit of the flow of the Warriors' offense. Or do you just allow Stephen Curry to do whatever you want to him again in game two? I don't know what the Clippers do, because ultimately they don't really stand a chance in the series. And I thought they gave the Warriors their best shot in game one, and we saw what the end result was, even though the Warriors played pretty poorly, all things considered.
Well, yeah, they had 21 turnovers. So do you look at those 21 turnovers and think, wow, they dodged a bullet there? That was almost their high for the whole season. Or do you think, hey, you know, that's just what they do, and most of the time those passes are great and they won, so who cares?
It didn't feel like it was. It didn't feel like it was a positive. That said, they had good energy. It wasn't necessarily a totally apathetic performance. I think they were just sloppy against a team that didn't threaten them. And you prefer those kind of airs as opposed to just messing around and the other team sort of getting into passing lanes and making things happen. The Warriors forced almost all of the airs that they committed in game one. So I would expect maybe a bit more simplistic basketball, one fewer passes, as ridiculous as that sounds. A lot of teams are looking for the extra pass or two extra passes. The Warriors might need to have one fewer pass per possession, because they were turning the ball over on kind of some fancy stuff at the very tail end of some of those great ball movement plays. But yeah, the Clippers, again, they just don't stand a chance out there. And you saw, I mean, the Warriors were leaving a lot of guys wide open last night. I thought the Clippers played fairly well in certain regards, especially on driving kick stuff. And the wide open guys couldn't knock down a shot to save their life. And that's par for the course of that Clippers team. Maybe they get hot for a game, but that's not anything you can really bank on. This series feels over already. It felt over certainly before the series started. I think the Clippers are the biggest underdog in the NBA playoffs in 30 years. But the fact that they were able to play probably their best game, and the Warriors turned the ball over 21 times, and it was sloppy, and Draymond Green was arguably their second-best offensive player, and DeMarcus Cousins was almost unplayable, and all of these things, the fact that the Warriors still ran away with it, we might as well just skip ahead to next week.
You're right about the odds, and Vegas had them at a minus 50,000, so you'd have to bet a lot of money to win very little. But, you know, it's kind of funny. If Steve Kerr is listening in his car right now, you said one less pass, he probably drove off the road.
I know. It's a totally ridiculous thing to say, and Lord knows I don't get paid as much as Steve Kerr for my analysis of the game of basketball. But it was funny. I mean, there were a lot of possessions that were wonderful, and then they tried to go from wonderful to stupendous, and that last pass in that sort of scheme just fell apart, and it was, you know, at the knees or it got booted away. That is only the Warriors. Only the Warriors have that problem where they're trying too hard to be that good. One less pass, maybe a couple more mid-range shots. Just hold on to the ball and they don't lose, because Lord knows there's nothing the Clippers can do in the half court to really stop them on offense.
You said Cousins unplayable, and of course we were all wondering how he'd be in his first game, and I'm sure he had some butterflies, and that's why I think Kerr left him out there just to, you know, this wasn't a elimination game. He wanted to see how he would respond, and he responded by fouling out and getting the hockey plus minus of a minus 17. That being said, though, he is a guy that the Warriors will need, and, you know, I know that Anthony Slater said he'd like the Looney on Harrell matchup better. Harrell was a grown man yesterday. I mean, he was playing really well. So how would you approach Cousins in game two then?
I'd be interested to see what Kerr does with the minutes, because if the Clippers are intent on having their two best players start the game on the bench, then the Warriors might need to make adjustments to the rotations. I thought Andrew Bogut looked really good in the 2 minutes that he played. I don't want to extrapolate that too far out, but a lot of times when Harrell was doing what Harrell was doing, and boy, that guy can scrap. He is an all-hustle team leader. It looked like the Warriors needed some rim protection, and Kevin Durant provided a little bit of it. Draymond Green was somewhat pulled out of the fray last night, so it wasn't really his role to go up and protect at the rim, though he certainly can do it. And DeMarcus Cousins just doesn't have the leaping ability to really be a force there. Bogut looked like a rim protector, as you would expect from him. And I thought it changed up the Clippers' game a little bit, because as Draymond Green said after the game, DeMarcus Cousins has never been schemed against like this. The playoffs are a totally different beast. And it's one of the things that we don't talk about maybe enough during the course of a regular season, but teams aren't really game planning. They're coming up with an idea or two, but they're really just throwing their best guys out there and they see what happens at the end of it. And for the Warriors, because they have so much talent, that's never really been much of an issue. In the playoffs, you will go directly at the weakest link again and again and again. There is no room for aesthetics or trying to play the right way. You're just trying to win. And if it looks rote and ridiculous, so be it. And the Clippers, to their credit, saw DeMarcus Cousins is not very good in pick and roll coverage. And they went at him with Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell again and again and again and again. And they put some wrinkles on top of it. And it was really good coaching by Doc Rivers. And I didn't see any adjustment from Boogie in game one. I'm fascinated to see what he does in game two. This is a guy, to his credit, that when he's had bad games so far in his short Warriors career, has really bounced back in the following game. So maybe it's just small things that he can do that makes him playable on the defensive end, and then maybe the shot starts falling on the offensive end, because the Clippers are going to leave him wide open to shoot all the threes he wants in the series. And he's not a terrible three-point shooter. It's not like it's Draymond out there. So that's a scheme that the Warriors are totally content with. But he has to be at least serviceable on the defensive end, and he was nowhere near that whatsoever in game one. And if that carries over early in game two, we need to see more Looney, and I think we could see some serious Bogut minutes, because at least you know he's going to provide solid defense, and on the offensive end, he's going to be competent and keep the ball moving.
Rick Tuttle with Dieter Kurtenbach of the Bay Area News Group. A couple more questions for Dieter here, 95.7 The Game. You know, you look around the league and you see all these hometown teams getting upset. We saw it in the Stanley Cup playoffs as well. And I kind of thought, reading between the lines last night, and you know, and we, you and I were just talking about how the odds are stacked up against the Clippers, that the Warriors didn't fall for it. You know, and I kind of feel like, you know, we've been doing this, you know, over 5 years now. In the last five, we've been pretty good. We're not falling for this whole, oh, we're going to be asleep in game one, which I thought was a great sign.
Yeah, I mean, we don't talk about this enough either, but the Warriors' experience in the playoffs is just obviously immense, but it really came in handy last night, because the situation that the Warriors would have put themselves in, a less experienced team, a team like the Nuggets last night against a still fairly young but obviously battle-tested Spurs team led by the greatest coach ever, the Nuggets couldn't rise to that occasion, and they had opportunity after opportunity to sort of get over the hump, but they didn't trust themselves enough in that moment. And the Warriors, you look at that game last night in the second quarter, and that second unit just falling apart, and the Clippers look like they're feisty and ready to go, and Stephen Curry trusted himself, and the Warriors trusted Stephen Curry to sort of lead them through it. And they didn't care about who got the points or what the rebounds were, looking good on the big stage. They just did what had to be done. And that comes with experience. That comes with knowing that you're not defined by one game, but in fact, the larger picture of this entire postseason and the larger picture of the past 5 years. And they were just so cool, calm, and collected. I thought during the game, lest we, you know, bring up the Patrick Beverley Durant situation at the end, which again, I think was just Durant having fun with Beverley for the sake of having fun with them. And then in the post-game press conference, you know, just, there was no panic. There was no, oh, we got to do this. They're totally comfortable in their station. They know how much better they are than the team that they're playing. And while they didn't put out their best performance last night, they know that it's not very far away and that they've been through the ups and downs of the playoffs before. It is the unspoken factor that decides a lot more than we ever give it credit for. Experience is almost everything in the postseason. And the Warriors have by far the most talent, and I would argue the most experience, and that's why they're the prohibitive favorites to win the title again.
And I think it's fascinating that before the season, when you looked at the Lakers, and you know, even halfway through the season, what were they, a four seed? And we thought, where are they? When are they going to, you know, match up with the Warriors in the playoffs? But they don't make it, and the Clippers do. And you think, well, who's the star? You just mentioned Williams and Harrell come off the bench. And I know, I mean, you could look at the Pacers and say, who's their dangerous guy, Bogdanovich? But they did have Oladipo before they got hurt. So I think what Doc Rivers has done, I'm not going to call him no names, but what he has done to get to the playoffs is outstanding.
What I love about this Clippers team is how they have maintained success on the micro, while I think they're in as good a position as any team in the Western Conference, and maybe any team in the NBA overall. I think the Brooklyn Nets are in a great position, but maybe the Clippers are even in a better position in the macro. This is a team that's pretty much top to bottom filled with the fourth or fifth best guy on a really good team. And so they can come wave after wave. They're just going to kill you with competence every minute of the game. And if you have a letdown like the Warriors did at the beginning of the second quarter last night, they will burn you. But this is not a team that anyone expected before the season to do much, at the midpoint of the season when they traded away their best player, Tobias Harris, to do much, and when they entered the playoffs to do much. And so while they have been overachieving all year, no matter what happens in this series, you really have to like where the Clippers are. And if they go out and get one of those top free agents, a Kawhi Leonard or possibly even a Kevin Durant, I really like the way that they are set up to contend in the West going forward. It would be a really good time to buy some Clippers stock, even though they don't seem like all that much right now.
Yeah, and not only did they get Shamit from Philly, they got two ones and two twos all together in the next 4 years. So if they mind their P's and Q's, they should be all right.
Yeah, and I love Tobias Harris, but that was a lopsided trade if there ever was one.
Yeah, and he had a stinker in game one for Philly, too. I'm sure he'll bounce back. But the Clips at one point, and they went on a little 10-0 run, And it was kind of funny because Kerr said, screw it, Hampton's five. This is I'm going with what I know. And it's kind of funny because in the first half of the season, that group together wasn't doing much. They played a lot better lately. But it, to me, it reminded me of a stand-up comedian who was trying his new stuff and it wasn't working. And he's like, I'm going to the well with my jokes that I know that can kill.
That's exactly right. I think I've done that on a couple of dates before, and it feels the same level of turnover. I can't recall the last time where the Warriors have gone to that death lineup with 6.5 minutes left in the second quarter. Kerr does not like playing it in the second quarter at all. He'll end games with it. Sometimes he'll end halves with it, but 6.5 minutes, that showed how feisty the Clippers can be. And I think it proved the point that was, again, the Clippers' best shot. And they were they actually had a little bit of a fight on their hands with this team. And we saw what Steph Curry did. We saw what the Warriors did. Andre Iguodala was absolutely fantastic in last night's game, and it doesn't show up on the box score because it never does. But his competence really helped turn the tide of that game. You put him on Lou Williams. Lou Williams is second thinking things in life, and that's not something Lou Williams does very often. And it really got him out of his element as well, because he started going for sort of the James Harden offense, trying to get to the basket and get fouls. And he found out pretty quickly in the playoffs, there's a little bit of a different whistle. And he spent the last like 2 minutes of the first half just whining and complaining to the referees, and the Warriors opened up even bigger lead. It was really awesome to see that lineup play so effectively, but I'm sure Steve Kerr doesn't want to have to use it again at any point during the first round series. You want to save that thing for Houston. You want to save that thing for whoever comes out of the bottom half of the bracket, and you definitely want to have it fresh for if this team gets to the NBA Finals, because I think the East is probably going to have a worthy adversary this year as opposed to years past. So go into it early in the second quarter of game two. Not according to plan, but it certainly worked, and maybe he can put it away for a while.
And you know you're going well, and you're a back-to-back champion when you're, you know, complaining about maybe a sub. But I look at Quinn Cook yesterday, 11 minutes, and, you know, he didn't look fantastic. And is that the type of situation where you'd say, well, what does it matter? He's just trying to give Steph a breather. Or is this the type of thing where you say, we need to find somebody else for those minutes?
Well, it's really tricky because the Warriors were obviously working with their rotations, and I don't know if they ever even fully figured it out right until more or less the last game of the year. As of late, they've been sort of tying Draymond Green and Steph Curry at the hip. They've been trying to get Kevin Durant a little bit of a stagger in there, and they want DeMarcus Cousins to be the anchor of that second unit, which starts the third and the fourth quarter. But with DeMarcus playing so poorly as he did in game one, and Klay Thompson not really having his best game to lift the tide there, the Quinn Cook minutes looked really rough. And again, it goes back to sort of the thing Draymond Green said, though he didn't say it about Quinn Cook, but Quinn's defensive liabilities have been on full display since he got into the NBA. He's such a great spot-up shooter that sometimes he can be a net zero player, but if he's not knocking down his shot, and he's not even creating his shot, and particularly in the playoffs when teams are going to target him because he's the weakest link out there, it is rough going. So I do think he'll stick with that rotation. And Quinn's not necessarily a point guard in that second unit. He's more of a wing player who's there for spot-up shooting, and that's something the Warriors really need with that second unit. So I think Kerr will probably stick with it for another game or two. But right now, I mean, everything has to be viewed through the lens of, will this work in the next round and the round beyond that and in the finals? And one game in, we don't have great results from DeMarcus Cousins, and we don't have great results from Quinn Cook, and that throws a lot of things into flux.
You know, a lot of times, I think it's just human nature that we don't live in the moment. We're always, you know, hashing out the past or looking to the future, and there's times when we just got to know that these are the good old days. And I was telling that to Giants fans in 10 and 12 and 14, like, you know, they're going to build statues to these guys someday, so just enjoy it. Last night, I bring that up because Curry now all-time three-pointers in playoffs, and he did it in 80 games quicker than the next guy, Ray Allen, and took 171 games to get the 385 threes. It took Curry 91 games, and it's just We all know how good he is. We all know the felicity and joy that he brings to all of us and to even some fans who don't even like the Warriors, the joy he brings. But it is time sometimes we just got to take a step back and you know, not be put him on a pedestal, but just to really let it soak in and just how fun it is to have that guy on our team.
It's totally preposterous. It is a ridiculous bit of luck for Golden State fans. And while you say you shouldn't put him on a pedestal, I would venture to say that he deserves the pedestal and as high as you can get it, because you look around the NBA right now and you watch these other games and you just see Stephen Curry's influence in so much. There are so many guys out there trying to be Steph Curry, and they will never be Steph Curry, but they're trying. And the game itself, with all the three-point shooting and the fact that the three seems more exciting than a dunk right now, that's Stephen Curry. And it's going to take a long time because we just don't respond to these sort of shifts well as people. But he changed the entire game of basketball. And we're living through it right now. We're living through his prime right now. He's still changing it. And he is a 6'3" guy, totally unimposing in every way, shape, and form relative to the players he's on the court with. And he is still head and shoulders better than the rest. And he's on a team with perhaps the greatest scorer of all time. And that guy has to play second fiddle a lot. It speaks to just the ridiculousness that is Stephen Curry. You know, I'm watching the Masters today and Tiger Woods wins and everyone's going off about how great of a moment it is. And I'm not one to disagree with them on that. But I still don't fully understand the cult of Tiger, because I watch Stephen Curry every night. And Stephen Curry is doing stuff that is reminiscent to me. Maybe this is just my addled brain, but reminiscent to me of what Tiger Woods did when he was on his hottest of hot streaks. Just completely changed the game and was transcendent and brought the joy, as you put it. I don't feel the same sort of love outside the Bay Area where everyone unites around Stephen Curry as this unifying force. And I think that down the line, we'll probably regret it, or knowing people, will probably be some revisionist history and we'll pretend like everyone loves Stephen Curry all along. But man, this guy is beyond special. This guy is a revolution. And well, it is awesome to watch it on a nightly basis for sure.
Yeah. And just one more thing. I don't know if you know, but 60 Minutes is doing a feature on Curry and the Warriors tonight. And that's when you kind of transcend out of the sporting world. I don't remember them doing a 60 Minutes on B-Weezy and Lincecum. But it's just, you know, I think people who don't even know what the Golden State Warriors or the NBA are, they probably know who Steph Curry is.
Here's how good the Warriors are, and this is all because of Steph Curry. I don't want to diminish the accomplishments of the others that have come with them, and Lord knows I will go on for hours about how Draymond Green is one of the most underrated players in the history of the NBA, and Klay Thompson is the second greatest shooter of all time. But this is Stephen Curry's team, and the Warriors are now wholly synonymous with incredible success compared to peers, head and shoulders. They're the Amazon of basketball, if we're using a business term. They're just so far and away better. The Golden State Warriors used to be the exact opposite of that. Not too long ago, they were the laughingstock of the entire league. They were a forgotten team in the Bay Area. And now, because of this, a guy who, again, no one would pick first in one-on-one, the Warriors are on 60 Minutes as sort of this template for how to be successful in life and business, transcending sports altogether. What a ridiculous run. But you can't write this stuff.
But you do, and you can read them in the Bay Area News Group. Dieter Kurtenbach.
Walked right into it.
He is the columnist there. Make sure to check him out and follow him on Twitter at @DKurtenbach. Dieter, great stuff. That was a giant love fest on Curry, but we did it because he deserves it. And anyway, thanks for your time and your insights, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Anytime, man. Thanks.
All right, good stuff. And as he mentioned, and we started off the show with this for those who missed it, we got a lot of people on the text line asking to talk about Tiger. You want to talk about Tiger? We're going to do it next. Golf people, where is you? That's right, bad grammar. 888-957-9570. Once again, 888-957-9570. Chilton Auto Body text line, 95795. Golf was dead, but like Lazarus, brought back to life. And on Palm Sunday, a 95.7 The Game.
This is the minute that millions around the world have waited for. Waited for years. Many doubted we'd ever see it. But here it is. The return to glory. Never thought we'd see anything that could rival the hug with his father in 1997. But we just did.
Now back to 95.7 The Game. Here's Rick Tittle.
Good night, John Boy. Man, that's some... This is the Masters music, Wes? I did not know that. Not a golf guy myself. But I'll tell you what. If you didn't hear, Tiger Woods, who just this morning won the 2019 Masters. And the green jacket. How about that? Steamrolling his way to his first major win since the U.S. Open in 2008. 11 years, ladies and germs. And normally we don't talk about golf, but when do you talk about golf? When it's Tiger winning the Masters on the morning that he did it. So I would love to hear from you golf people. How does this resonate with you one way or another? At 888-957-9570. We're going to talk NBA playoffs in the next segment. We're going to bring in Michael Lee from The Athletic. We'll get back to all that we've been talking about with the Warriors all day. Where does this sit with you today? Do you give a hoot or do you pollute? 888-957-9570. The Chilton Auto Body text line 95795. I have never seen a sport in my life, and you can correct me if you can think of another example, where the general public only cares about one person, and that's Tiger. If you are a golf fanatic, then you're into Rory and Lefty and Jordan Spieth and DJ and Ricky Fowler, all these guys I've interviewed before, my syndicated show. I respect golf. I don't like it, per se. I can't love everything, but I respect it. I know how hard it is. I've tried. Ask Townie, who I golfed with at the celebrity thing for 4.5 hours, or I was in a cart with him. Or ask Herbs, who's probably in his car right now. He's coming in to do the show after mine. When's he coming in? 4? Yeah. We golfed with the great Vida Blue. Dropping names, picking them up. It's hard. To me, the fun about golf is dropping off the face of the earth for 4.5 hours. That's what's fun, and drinking beers and driving around a cart. Yes, you can drink and drive, but still be, of course, responsible. Don't drive on the green like Trump. But Tiger began the day tied for second. And the leader from Italia, Francesco Molinari, he'd been steady all week. But he messed up. Imbecile, testa di cazzo. He led most of the day, but he had a double bogey on 15. What do tigers do in nature? When they see an opening, they pounce. And pounce he did. Because he birdied the par 5 15 for the third time this week. And then he had the par 3 16th. And he got it in 2. He almost had a hole in 1. He walked up 17 with a 2-stroke lead on Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka. Then he finished with a par. He had a bogey on 18. But he brought it home. So a 5-time Masters champion. Stands alone as the second most in the sport's history. Only the Golden Bear himself, yes, Jack Nicklaus, won 6. It's his first Masters since 2005. Now, are you shocked? I'm not shocked. I'm very surprised because after 11 years and everything that's gone on in his life, in his personal life, and with the injuries and everything he's had to do with the surgeries and the meds and everything else, you'd think that his prime was well past him. But you can't count out one of the greatest of all time to conjure up on a very special weekend something like this. So I wouldn't have put 2 cents on him winning the Masters. Rick, he'd been playing well lately. Well, I didn't know. I wasn't paying attention to golf. I'm sorry. I got a bigger fish to fry. It's not my fave. But I do know what this means to the sport. This will be a renaissance to the sport. It is reborn to the general public. And it's pretty amazing how much one guy matters. And I was saying, it's like, you know, the 100-meter dash. Usain Bolt? No, he ain't running. I'll skip it. I get that, but that's an event. This is an entire sport. And I said 10 years ago on the air they should just rename golf Tiger. And I was serious. They would sell more crap, and they would get better ratings if you just said, are you watching Tiger today? Have you seen Tiger? Are you going to play some Tiger? I got a Muni course. Let's go down there. It's only $20. We can play some Tiger. What do you think? 888-957-9570. Let's go to Jock in the Yoon. You're on 95.7 The Game. Jock. Jock. Last time. Jock. All right. I said a double bogey on 15. The 510 on the text line said 12th hole, dummy. Well, this is from a report by Kyle Porter, a report by Kyle Boone, and also another report by Chip Patterson. All three professional golf writers, and they all wrote the 15th. So if you want to call anybody a dummy, call those three professional golf writers the dummy. Okay? You're the dummy. No, you're the dummy. No, you're the dummy. Remember that with James Woods? Maybe you don't. But this is also true that everything you say on the air, someone will write in. I remember one time I said, so A.J. Griffin's ERA is now a 4.81. Someone wrote in, it's a 4.82, you idiot. Fire this guy, man. Get him off the air. Sorry. What does this mean for you for anything? It's funny because whenever I should say, I don't know about you, but whenever I go to Europe, people always want to talk about the president, whoever it is, like we're best friends for whoever's in office. But in the 80s, people always asked me if I knew Eddie Murphy. All the time I spent in England as a soccer writer and coaching football to the police department. Yes, American football. I say football because it's football. But they, do you know Tiger? Oh, bloody hell, Tiger is all right. He's brilliant, isn't he? Oh, you got to meet Tiger? I'm like, yeah, I don't know Tiger. Like, have you ever seen him in person? Yeah, I went to a pro-am. He saw Tiger. It was like the second coming. That's how big Tiger was. Worldwide. Worldwide. All right, let's go to Jock in the Yoon. What's up, Jock?
Hey. Everything's fantastic. Like you said, golf is reborn to a lot of the world. I, like you, stopped following it as much as I was before. And then somebody said, hey, you got to watch Tiger this week. I said, in the Masters? And luckily I did. I taped it. And he is transcendent. You know, I'm originally from New York, lived in Chicago. I'm out here now, and Tiger's everywhere when they think about golf. Without him, what's that thing with the little white ball?
Yes.
That's the idea.
So you're New York and Chicago. So do you say sausage or do you say sausage?
Sausage.
Both. Thanks, Jock. I appreciate it. That's Jock out there in Union City. But he's right. It's Tiger. And everybody rushes to the TV, even people who don't even care about golf. It's Tiger. I remember learning something, and it's absolutely true. And like, if you go out on the street right now and you go to a street corner and, I don't know, pick a cause, save the whales. Okay. You go out on the street and you hold a sign and it says save the whales. You might get two people to honk and give you a thumbs up. Save them whales. If Tom Cruise went down to the corner and held a sign that said save the whales, you'd have every ENG crew in the city. You'd have CNN. You'd have TMZ, every podunk. Why? Because star power. That's what it is. And Tiger has that star power more than anyone else. Chilton Autobody text line 95795. Golf isn't a real sport. Tiger is all they have. Otherwise, it's irrelevant. Golf is a sport. Of course, I have to say this. Obviously, it's a sport. If you want to categorize it as more of a game of skill like darts or bowling, go ahead. I can tell you it is a highly difficult sport to play. And it's also, I would think, one of the highest. I'm sure there are other disciplines and sports in the world, but it's one of the highest ever when it comes to the mental side of things. I mean, no one's chasing you. You're not chasing anything. You don't ever have to run. And all the momentum comes from you. You initiate the inertia, if you can allow me that one. And so that's why people, I remember when I worked in TV for 10 years, we used to flog these things in the early mornings. Everybody's coming up with a new gadget. There was this thing called the Medicus. It was an iron. It was a pitching wedge, I think, that cracked in the middle. And so if you brought it up too quickly, in the middle of it, it would go, and it would be like a right angle, and it would flop. And so it kept you to make sure you had one arm straight and the other arm elbow in, whatever it was. I don't know the form, but it was to make sure you kept your form. And I thought, Medicus, that sounds like Caesar's doctor. Caesar's water is blue, like King George III. They had these, I mean, even the Rodney Dangerfield and Caddyshack with the little boop, 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 telling you when to hit it. It's a highly psychological sport. And that's why, and I told the story earlier about going to the Pro-Am, and Tiger's like, oh, someone sneezed. My life is ruined. By the way, on the text line, someone questioned me ever having doubted Jeff Foxworthy. I said earlier, I don't know how it is now. This was, 20 years ago. But I went to the Pro-Am at AT&T. I got dragged down there, and you had to park at Fort Ord in Monterey, and then you get on these buses, and they would take you to, Pebble, Spyglass, Mission Bay, whatever. And the bus driver said, can I put in a Jeff Foxworthy tape? And I'm thinking, no, he's a hillbilly. And it was hilarious. I do remember two lines. He said, Southern people invent words like, widgie did you? You didn't bring your truck, widgie did you? And another word Southerners have invented, aorta. You know, with this extra value meal, I ought to give you more fries with it. Yes. By the way, you can listen to Jeff Foxworthy on your own. I'll stop with that. 956 area code, which I think is Mercury. Golf majors rate as high as the NBA finals. I would say when Tiger is doing well. I have seen the numbers before. And yes, I know the Masters, for people who love golf, it's sacred ground. And I always try to be very respectful for sports that aren't my favorite, because I'm a huge soccer fan. And to me, there's the World Cup, and then there's everything else. There's the Billy Bean 50 feet of dung, and then there's everything else. So people who are like, oh, World Cup, who gives a damn? That's fine. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not trying to talk you. Some guy said, all right, you got 10 minutes. Talk me into soccer. I'm like, I don't give a damn if you like soccer. You can do whatever you want. You can vote for who you want with. You can have a religion or be an atheist. I don't care what you think. I only care what I think. Just, I don't understand people have to argue about all this stuff, but I do respect it. It's like, I'm not a big rugby fan, but I respect rugby. It's a tough sport, just like I respect golf. And I have had the pleasure of interviewing a lot of golfers over the years. I've never interviewed Tiger. A colleague of mine did when he was at Stanford. That's about the time you were going to get Tiger, when he was at Stanford. Other than that, he was a pretty hard get. Chilton by text line 95795. Tiger's going bald. Yes, he's getting up there. He's not at Stanford anymore. But this is all part of the tell us something we don't know text line. Let's go to the phone lines. 888-957-9570. Diego is in Sac. What's up, Diego?